From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We're going to start with coverage on the Aurora mass shootings. Clint Van Zandt is here, former FBI agent, profiler, author, safety expert. Clint, how are you?
Just fine, Dana. Good evening.
12 dead, 58 injured, mass shootings in Toronto 6 weeks before that. When's this going to stop? Let's talk about it.
Well, I don't think it's going to, unfortunately. Dana, you and I know from our law enforcement experience and your listeners from following cases like this, there's a lot of people that sit on the psychological edge and all they need is a push or just make a decision to jump off themselves and do something like this. You know, I've seen, when this first broke, I saw a couple of people on TV and this one woman was saying, oh, he's a sociopath, he's a psychopath. And, you know, I don't think so. I think that's, especially in America, maybe around the world, you know, we're quick to put a label on somebody, and then we want to say, what's the cause and what's the cure, you know?
Yeah.
I've got the flu because I shook hands with somebody, and now all I have to do is drink enough chicken soup, and I'm going to get better again. I don't know that psychologically we get better necessarily.
Clint Van Zandt's here. A lot of talk of insanity defenses, but, you know, put it together. The premeditation, the diversion with the loud music and the booby trap in his place, the ammunition, the weapons, that now the diary that was mailed off to the psychiatrist. Let's talk about the part, is he crazy or is he just planned the whole thing to get attention?
Well, you know, what we'll wind up with is one or more psychiatrists on the side of the prosecution and on the defense, and they'll tell us two different things. I mean, you know, we're still going to have multiple versions. I think the little bit that I have seen of this guy, Dana, and his background, I mean, a good friend of mine who's a clinical psychologist, I mean, we're in agreement that you're likely to see, you know, this individual suffering from schizophrenia. As you know, that normally you start to you see the signs of that between about 15 and 25. So this guy's in the ripe age. You lose the ability many times to distinguish between you know, what's real and what's not real. And know that, you know, I'm not suggesting that if someone has a mental illness, therefore they're fully capable of doing this. Again, the vast majority of people around the world who suffer from any type of a mental illness don't pick up a gun, don't commit mass murder. If they present any threat at all, unfortunately, it's to themselves and not others. But in this particular case, we've got potentially a very rare blend. We've got an extremely smart individual. We know that, for example, schizophrenia, it becomes exacerbated when an individual gets under stress. We know that this bright guy, top of his undergraduate class, he's in a first year of a four-year doctoral program, and he failed a test, perhaps leaving, said he was leaving the school at the time. So I think there was a lot of things coming down on him. Now, that's not to make an excuse. That's not to justify mass murder or anything at all. But it's simply saying if we want to try to understand how an otherwise reasonably bright person could commit an act like this, I think we have to, in this particular case, look at mental illness. And again, we haven't seen sociopathic, psychopathic behavior in his background. He hasn't been this terrible person committing robbery, rape, and mayhem and everything else. He's been all right, but I think what we may well see is somebody who has gradually started to slip more and more. Life came crashing down on him, and he was bright enough. Number one, I think he chose to occupy his time building this terrible explosive apartment that I thought from day one was a diversionary device. Mm-hmm. I thought he wanted to set that off. He wanted to blow up the third floor of that apartment building he lived on. He wanted every first responder in town to rush 3 or 4 miles away from that movie theater to his apartment, which would therefore leave him with this killing field in front of him, number one, and the ability to escape, number two. So when that apartment didn't blow up, when first responders flooded the area of the movie theater, I think this guy was really surprised that his plan didn't work. And that may account for what some people would say, well, it's crazy. Why didn't he just let somebody go in the apartment after the fact? I think after the fact, there wasn't a need for it because his plan didn't work. This is a scientific mind who is used to things being very orderly. When the order broke down, I think his plan broke down, and he, for whatever his reason, thank God, saw the a reason to warn police officers about the potential explosive devices. That warning probably saved the life of a police officer. But, of course, we had a dozen killed and, 58 wounded prior to that time.
You know, one of the first things that you learn in police work is to expect the unexpected. What about the first responders and getting a call to a theater like this? Let's talk about them and how they did.
Well, you know, this is going to be a classic case of post-traumatic stress reaction, I think, for the first responders. I mean, police officers, they're used to going to crime scenes, they're used to seeing, you know, a few people injured, maybe an automobile accident or something like that. And you, Dana, and all the other, men and women in uniform, we have what we call alienation of affection. That means you can come to a very violent crime scene. You can see babies dead and people dead and horrible rapes and murders and decapitations. And you can take a deep breath and say, okay, this is my job, I have to do it. And you go in and you do it, and you do a good job. But then comes after the fact. I mean, I've experienced post-traumatic stress reaction after hostage situations where everybody was going to die and knives to the throats and things like that. I did fine during the situation, but afterwards, when the whole reality of it came crashing down on you, I think that's what these first responders, this is something that no one expects to see in their law enforcement, their medical, their firefighting career. So I think this is going to be a challenge for those men and women for years. It's just like we see our troops coming back from overseas. Some have been, they have physical wounds you can see from improvised explosive devices, but others are just as shattered emotionally. It just doesn't show as a wound on them, but those wounds are still just as deep and just as powerful within the person as they are outside on the body.
Clint, you and I have talked about safety many, many times in public, how to react in situations. Was there anything that could be done to prevent something like this from happening?
Well, it's interesting. You know, you made reference at the start of your program to this alleged journal or notebook that was mailed that supposedly was received by a psychiatric professor at the same school where the shooter went to about 8 days prior to it. But, of course, it wasn't found until yesterday. We don't know the contents yet. We don't know if that's even real or if it's fake. We don't know why it just surfaced. So there are many more unknowns than knowns. But, you know, were it a perfect world and were that something this young man had generated, there are probably going to be those who say, well, wasn't that a cry for help? Wasn't he trying to get some type of help? Well, you know, I wish he would have cried louder. I wish he would have dialed 911. You know, I wish a lot of things would have happened before then. But there are... just like in the case of suicide, where we know there are 2 to 4% of the population that are suicidal, that will commit suicide, there's nothing we can do to stop them in law enforcement. It's just going to happen. We also know that about 6% of any population group has a predisposition to schizophrenia, and they're going to react different to that, too. So, we will do a lot of hand-wringing, Dana. We in the States... We'll talk about, weapons again and high-capacity magazines and semi-automatic assault weapons and all this. The bottom line is, in the United States, there's about 92 firearms for every 100 people. If we stop selling guns today, 500 years from now, we'd probably have 80 guns per 100 people.
Yeah.
And to me, we have to deal with guns. We have to deal with high-capacity magazines. Are there a need for those in the hands of the public? But we also have to find a way to identify people in need for mental health assistance and find some way to identify them and get them help before we see somebody act out terribly like this young man did, and like there will be those in the future that will act out in a similar way. This guy was smarter, he was brighter, he had money, he was able to put his plan together, but the bottom line is we had an act of mass murder by someone who otherwise did not appear to have any predisposition to do something like this.
Clint Van Zandt's here. Clint, you segued into my next question. Let's talk about the media coverage and the potential for copycats.
I think the potential for copycats is great. I've spent too many years as an FBI agent arresting people for a crime. I worked a lot of bank robberies in New York area, and I'd arrest someone for bank robbery, and I'd say, you know, why'd you rob the bank? And he'd say, well, I saw somebody on the newspaper, on television, they got away with it. It sounded like a good idea. There are a lot of people, Dana, who are not original thinkers in this world. It's like the incidents of violence in a workplace that we see where someone chooses to pick up a weapon and go into his or her workplace and just mow everybody down because they're angry, they're frustrated. They're rageful, they're depressed, whatever the plethora of emotions that they're going through, they act out against some type of population group who, in their own mind, they hold responsible. The, again, challenging thing in this situation we just saw is that we don't know that he is necessarily holding any one person responsible. We don't know why he chose to act out in that movie setting, but we do know that television has been quick to advertise and suggest that this guy now has the record, that he has killed the most people at one time in one situation, I mean, surpassing Virginia Tech and anything else. There are those who will look at that, who see that the flags of the country are flown at half-mast, that the President of the United States and other people are talking about what you did. And if you want to know a way to get your terrible 15 minutes of attention, it's going to be trying to surpass this guy's record.
Last thing, Quint, and I appreciate you coming on tonight. A couple of quick tips for the public. We're telling you, don't be afraid. Go out and live your lives as you do. But there's always something if you're in a mall setting or if you're in a movie or if you're in a group of many people and something happens, whether it's an earthquake or someone with a gun or that panic. What do you do when that panic all of a sudden sets in? How do you react?
Well, I think one of the ways you deal with it is that you think in advance, what should I do? I mean, I go into a movie theater, I go into a mall, you know, I'm just going in to, you know, get my popcorn and soda and sit down. But as I walk in, I'm also looking for the emergency exits. I want to know where they're at. I want to know, is there lighting that's going to get me to it? It's just like when you get on an airliner and they tell you where the exits are and they tell you about the life rafts and life preservers and things. I think that every time we go in a situation, not out of paranoia, but just out of common sense, to be looking around you, know what's around you, know who's around you, and know a way out. And then, like a violence in a workplace situation or anything else, if that worst-case scenario happens, you have to be able to make, you know, one of three different decisions. One is to hunker down in place. Number two is to run. Or number three is to attack your attacker. And you've got to be prepared to do all three, but at least know what your options are. That deer in the headlight is not going to say, look, it's not going to save your life. But if you think in advance and you react to a situation based upon, okay, I've thought it out, I know what my options are, then I think you've got a better chance of surviving.
Absolutely. Clint, as always, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Dana. Good to be with you.
Bye-bye. That's former FBI agent Clint Van Zandt. Someone who's been there, done that. And the tips for the public, I think, are the most important. Can you prevent something like this from happening again? Of course not. I agree with Clint and the others that I'll have on the program tonight that the potential for copycat is great. But in your situation, and hope to God that it doesn't happen for you, sit back and think. Take a look around. look where those emergency exits are, you know. Decide what you're going to do, like Clint said. When you get into a panic and everybody is running, it's something that's very hard to get through. Someone with a gun is there shooting. If there's a fire, if there's something, you got to figure how to get out, how to survive. You take your instincts. Look at this case. Look at the boyfriends that that were killed shielding their girlfriends. That human instinct of protecting someone came through. There's a lot of heroes, a lot of stories. We'll hear more and more as the time goes on. The only coward was the shooter himself. The only coward was the one who put those bullets in those magazines and started firing. The blame game will start now. They're even blaming the motion picture company, the theater, for not having proper security, getting out the exit door. The question now, and Robin Sachs will talk about it in a little bit, will be, is the school culpable in something like this? Because they were warned by Holmes himself, allegedly, that this is what he was going to do and this is how he was going to do it, and the mail never got delivered, allegedly. So there's all these things that happen, but really the most important thing is protecting yourself and protecting your family. I'm Dana Pretzer. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back, and we're going to continue on with our coverage on the Aurora mass shootings. Did you hear this story about Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York? And again, would gun control help in situations like this? Banning illegal guns. Some of the guns that Holmes had were illegal, according to Mitt Romney. I'm not sure if he knows all the facts. None of us really do. But get a load of what Bloomberg told Piers Morgan on CNN. It's too bad he went on Piers Morgan because he only has a couple of listeners. No, I shouldn't say that. On Monday night, when asked by cable TV host Piers Morgan, according to Fox News, why Americans don't demand tougher laws in such a tragedy, he said, "I would take it one step further. I don't understand why police officers across this country don't stand up collectively and say, we're going to go on strike. We're not going to protect you unless you, the public, through your legislature, do what's required to keep us safe." Now he's saying, I don't literally mean go on strike. In fact, New York police can't go on strike. That's against the law. He's a gun control guy and anti-NRA, etc., and he's trying to get his point across that if there were more gun control regulation, then maybe something like this wouldn't happen, or maybe it would be prevented. I don't know. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. I sat down with clinical psychologist Dr. Dale Archer to talk about the effects of something like this, not only on the victims, their families, but the first responders. And is there a potential for an insanity plea in this case? Here's what Dr. Archer had to say. Okay, we're back. Continuing on with the story of the mass shooting in Aurora, Dr. Dale Archer is here. Reports are coming out now that, and I'm sure you've heard, that there was a notebook sent to a University of Colorado psychiatrist outlining everything that would be done in the theater. Unfortunately, it wasn't delivered to the psychiatrist. We've seen the pictures of the accused in the courtroom, blinking his eyes, appears to be medicated. It's hard to say. Let's start with this notebook. It's hard to have an insanity defense when you've planned everything and you've mailed it away to your psychiatrist, isn't it?
Well, there are a couple of things that brings up in my mind. First of all, I wonder if this was his treating psychiatrist, because it would seem very random to me that he picks out an unknown psychiatrist in the University of Colorado system and sends him a notebook. Number two, this was a new onset psychosis. And what folks need to understand is that it's not like you're going along totally normal and then boom, the brain breaks and you're psychotic. This comes on over a period of several months, and you'll have some good days and some bad days. I suspect that he knew he was getting psychotic, and during his times of clarity, he was putting everything down because a part of him actually wanted to have the plot stopped. So
I think as this comes along, we're going to find out this was his psychiatrist. This was his way of trying to get an outside source involved to stop him. In terms of the insanity defense, you're absolutely correct. Folks also need to understand, I believe he was psychotic, but psychotic is a medical term. Insanity is a legal term. And typically those who get the insanity plea are indeed psychotic, but they're about the top 1% in terms of severity. I do believe he planned this out in meticulous detail. I do not feel he will meet the insanity requirements that would be necessary for him to be found not guilty by insanity. All that being said, though, I think the big question here, the big legal question with respect to his mental health, is going to revolve around competency and not sanity. And, of course, competency is how he is faring right now and whether he is competent to assist his attorney in defending him.
Dr. Dale Archer is here. The old question, understanding the difference between right and wrong. You know, being able to say that this person knew what he was doing was wrong, understanding that that is a big question in these cases, but all you have to do is look at what's before us, and of course we haven't seen everything. How important will that be for the prosecution to be able to say this guy knew exactly what he was doing?
Well, knowing right from wrong only comes into play when you're talking about insanity, and that takes place at the time of the crime. So in order to prove insanity, the individual needs to be gravely disabled, and he needs to not know the difference between right and wrong. Clearly, in this case, he was not so disabled that he could not plan out this elaborate details necessary for him to kill all these people. So that doesn't meet the criteria for insanity right there at all. In terms of the right from wrong, we don't really know, but you know what? You need to have both of those. So it's not just enough to say right from wrong at the time of the episode, because we know for a fact that he had the ability to plan the whole thing out, which indicates he was not gravely disabled enough to be able to meet this criteria. Now, of course, none of this has anything at all to do with competence, which, again, is what is his mental state right now?
Dr. Dale Archer's here. 12 dead, 58 injured. It's hard to put yourself right in the melee, although we've heard the 911 tapes and seen some video. But what about the families of the victims? What about the victims that have survived themselves? What can they do? How long will this affect them? Probably for the rest of their lives.
Well, of course, we worry about post-traumatic stress disorder. And we know that when you're exposed to a severe stress such as this, that PTSD will affect about 1 in 5 people, about 20%. Typically, the more acutely you're involved, the greater the likelihood. So those who have been shot will have a greater risk than those who were there. Those who were there will have a greater risk than the responders who came in. But certainly, everyone in that town of Aurora is going to have some increased stress and some propensity. And when we're talking about post-traumatic stress, folks need to understand that this is an illness that it requires flashbacks, nightmares, and actually reliving the event. And what happens is you have this horrible event that happens to you, and you can't get it out of your mind. So it keeps replaying over and over in your dreams, in your thoughts. And if that goes on long enough, that can become untreatable. The good news is if you get help right away, you're starting to have those symptoms, then it's very treatable. But certainly everyone will be at some increased risk. The key is if you're starting to have the symptoms of reliving this in your mind, that's a warning sign, a red flag. You need to get in and get help.
There have been several mass shootings in the last, I think, 6 to 8 weeks. We've heard the story of the young girl, who sports broadcaster, who was in Toronto and just missed a mass shooting there, but was unfortunately killed here. What about the potential of copycats, Dr. Archer?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I went back and did a research on the number of mass shootings that we've had over the last 100 and some odd years, and starting in the early 1900s, there was about one event per decade, so really not that much. But in the 80s, there were 9 mass shootings. In the 90s, there were 11. And from 2000 to present, there have been 26. So by all accounts, this is becoming more and more common. And of course, it begs the question of what is causative here. So I think the copycat phenomenon is real. And I think that there's a very real risk that we will see more of these in the not-too-distant future. It's becoming an epidemic. It really is.
Well, I hope not, but I have to agree with you. Dr. Dale Archer, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Okay, that's Dr. Dale Archer, clinical psychologist, drdalearcher.com. You'll see him on Dr. Drew and other cable news shows, along with his own television program. I guess, the concern of copycats is very real. How the media covers the story and the ideas that are thrown out there, are they reason for a copycat to come forward, or is this something that copycat's been working on for a while, or again, that 15 minutes or 15 seconds of fame and the tragedy that follows after a lunatic like this? We talked about it. The poor young girl from that was in Toronto and missed a mass shooting at the mall there. 6 weeks later, she's dead in a mass shooting at a Batman premiere. Is this something where there's too much violence in video games, too much violence in movies? We could debate this on and on and on, and who knows where it's going to end. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk about how do you prosecute a case like this. Well, we'll go right to the DA and ask her. I'm Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Hey, we're back. You know, one of the big questions now that's come out in the media is the package that was sent to Colorado State University. According to Fox News, the package that remained unopened for as long as a week before it was discovered on Monday was possible that it was a potential warning prior to Friday's tragic events. But the question still remains, if the package was opened, what could the psychiatrist have done? Is there a doctor-patient confidentiality issue here? If the person receiving the package was not his doctor, then that person had no obligation than to do anything other than immediately call the police, said Dr. Michael First, a professor of clinical psychiatry at the Columbia University Medical Center. There is no doctor-patient confidentiality between them if that's the case. It has not been verified if the indeed recipient of Holmes' package had been treating Holmes or if they even had previous contact. However, Holmes is a recent dropout out of the school's neuroscience program. So if he's not the doctor, you send it in. Keith Ablow, a psychiatrist, a member of the Fox News team, if a psychiatrist patient discusses a plan to do harm to someone during a therapy session, then the medical professional has a key legal obligation to take action. It's just unfortunate, if true, that this package was sent there and this actually happened, that nobody opened it and this tragedy wasn't prevented. I sat down with DA Robin Sachs, former DA Robin Sachs, to see her thoughts on how do you prosecute a case like this. Okay, we're back. You all know Robin Sachs. She's a former ADA from Los Angeles County. She's currently the legal analyst at Fox 11 LA. She's an attorney, an author, and a good friend of the program. Hi, Robin.
Hello. I'm so happy to be here.
Nice to have you on the show. Too bad that we have to talk about such a depressing story. 12 dead, 58 injured. We're seeing stories now that this kook actually had a notebook that he had sent to a University of Colorado psychiatrist, and it sat in the mailroom. It was never delivered. All sorts of stories. This thing is going to spin 100 different ways. What I thought I would do is bring you on the program to talk from the DA's perspective. There's lots of talk about insanity defenses, all that sort of stuff. We can look at it and say, how can you do that? It's been so premeditated. He ordered all these weapons, ammo, and now this book. How would Robin Sachs prosecute this case?
Well, first of all, I would, the first thing is, let's start with the most current development that you just alluded to, which is this journal that he sent to the psychiatrist, psych, psychology department, I believe it was, and one of the psychology professors there. And that, and preceding that, there was another package that there was a concern was contained a bomb. It did not contain a bomb, but they found that package, and through the search of that, found this other package. The other issue is that there's some 90 packages that this creep, sicko, disgusting, vile human being, sent to the university that contained ammunition and various things that were used for, you know, in the planning of this awful massacre. So, you know, to me, there is a huge, huge issue and missed opportunity and liability and culpability from the University of Colorado at Denver. You know, if the signs and symptoms were there, and if we go back and look at this and this turns into a Penn State where they had an ability to do something and did not, then not only do I hold Holmes responsible, which of course we do, but I hold that university responsible as well. That's my thoughts on that.
Robin,
but in terms of I won't blab a lot. I'll let you ask me the next question.
No. You can blab. That's why I bring you on the show, because you're very good at what you do. And I was just going to say, but Robin, when you see this, this book that sat in the mailroom of the University of Colorado, and everything else that he's done, how about the and I don't want to get into a debate as far as gun control, but what about the ability to have these automatic weapons, being able to order all of this ammunition, the fact that he had tripwired his apartment for, I consider that a diversion, the loud music, call the cops come there, the place blows up, there's going to be resources at that place rather than at the movie theater. What about all that?
All that goes to the bigger issue. I mean, there's a couple of issues that it goes to. First of all, you allude to the one issue of gun control and the ability to access firearms and all of that. And I just want to make the one point of, I don't know that any gun control rules or laws would have changed the outcome in this case, unfortunately.
Right.
And maybe it perhaps made things a hair easier for him. But I think that this was someone who was so calculated in every which way and form that no gun control law would have stopped this guy. He was going to snap. He was going to snap one form or another. But in terms of the insanity and in terms of preparing a case, prosecutors, listen, there's only a few defenses out there. The defense is number one, it wasn't me, an ID issue. Obviously, the guy was caught red-handed. He turns himself in right there. His mom corroborates, it's him. You don't have an ID issue. The next defense in the case is the crime that you said I didn't really do. Well, you've got dead bodies spewed around, people in hospitals, injured, hurt people all over the place. You can't say the crimes didn't happen. The crimes happened. So then where do you go? The only place to go is an insanity or mental sort of defense. Some people would say, like myself, you got to be crazy to kill anyone to begin with, right? Anyone who shoots a gun and kills someone is nuts.
Yeah.
But is nuts insane for the legal purposes? And the things that prosecutors are going to be doing and what the defense is doing too are going to be looking at the various factors that would make it such that he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't know the nature and extent of what he was doing. And the more preparation, the more planning, the more ability to know the difference between right and wrong, the more unlikely that defense won't fly. And I think, believe it or not, as silly as this may sound, one of the best pieces of evidence the prosecution has is those dating ads that have surfaced, that reports have been made that he was on some, adult finder site and matched type of sites, and even potentially visited online forums for prostitutes. Some of the comments he made, or allegedly had made, that are on those sites say, "Will you visit me in prison?" It's a very, very good piece of evidence for the prosecution, because what that piece of evidence says is, I know what I'm doing could get me in trouble. And that is basically the test for insanity. Do you know the nature and extent of what you're doing? Do you have the ability to know the difference between right and wrong? And, not are you a nutball or doing something that's outrageous, not whether you fall asleep during court or whether you stare off in weird places. All of those things can be feigned. It's things that can show those objective factors. And another fact that that people get confused with insanity, it is not up to the prosecution to prove him sane. Insanity is a defense. So after the prosecution proves their case, it would be up to the defense, Holmes and his attorneys, to prove that he was insane at the time, and the burden shifts to him, and then therefore it becomes a case where it's not like the prosecution hasn't met their burden of proof. It's now, does the defense meet their burden?
Absolutely. Robin Sachs is here. Just before I let you go, just switch topics for a quick second. The Anaheim shooting, I just watched a quick news clip of you on Fox LA. What's going on there?
Well, in Anaheim, there was a shooting. You know, some people would compare it to the Trayvon Martin shooting. Some people here in Los Angeles are looking at this as a Rodney King shooting. There was a unarmed gang member who was shot by police just over the last few days. And what has happened today was that there was a filing of a lawsuit, $50 million lawsuit, against the police department in the city on behalf of the estate of Manuel Diaz and his family for wrongful death. And it's interesting, normally when I comment on these cases, I always get really annoyed the people who file their civil lawsuits before even the police investigation has been written and the ink has dried in the case before it gets its way to prosecution, because a civil suit generally does not help the perceptions and what happens in a criminal case. But in this particular case, I actually changed my tune, that I think that it's a very good idea that there was a civil suit that was filed immediately, because one of the issues in this case is issues that are going on in Anaheim through a lot of protesting that are going on there, is how transparent, how much access to information, what kind of corruption is going on. And there's always the fear that when the police becomes the defendant, and the police is the one who could be the ones responsible for the criminal and or civil conduct, that if they are in charge of the investigation or if their buddies are in charge of the investigation, the evidence that is going to help the case objectively be decided by a jury will somehow disappear. So by filing a case, all of a sudden it puts restraining orders in effect, gives subpoena power to attorneys. So in this case, well, it may feel like this may be a rush for money here. This is a family that's alleging that the police had shot him several times, one time in the knees where he would have just fallen. He was unarmed, and the officers were not dressed in uniform. And then the police alleged that after being shot in the knees and he was already on the ground, that he was shot in the back of the head. If those allegations become true, it's a real problem for Anaheim. And everyone would agree that the family would deserve any amount of money that they were seeking.
Absolutely. It's a story that I'm sure we'll be hearing lots more of. Robin Sachs, always a pleasure. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you so much.
Take care. That's Robin Sachs, a former assistant district attorney in Los Angeles County. She's now an attorney in Los Angeles and a legal analyst for Fox TV and my Fox LA. And I think she says it best when it comes to figuring out this case or trying to figure out this case. Will there be an insanity defense? Oh, maybe. It's hard to say. But when you look at the premeditation, you look at the planning, you look at everything that he did, the potential for this notebook to outline everything that was going to happen, that may have happened, even down to the fact we're going on to the website saying, will you visit me in jail? This idiot, this scum of the earth, this piece of garbage had planned this all along. It's unfortunate that those that were attending the movies, the victims, didn't plan for something like that to happen. I'm going to end tonight's show with, I don't normally do this, with a little clip of what I have planned for tomorrow in the Daily Commentary. We'll end with these words, and we'll catch you again real soon here. So media reports are now saying that the accused in the Aurora mass shooting at the Batman premiere sent a notebook of what he was planning to do to the University of Colorado and to a psychiatrist. Was this his psychiatrist? No one is sure right now. The media reports are mixed on that. Is there now a culpability as far as the University of Colorado and them not getting the mail delivered to the psychiatrist? Well, it's possible. We'll have to wait and see. Not compared to Penn State, but yet compared to Penn State, how responsible is the university for this mass shooting? Well, again, we have to say that Holmes himself is the one that pulled the trigger, but look at all that ammunition that was sent to him. Look at the automatic weapons that he was able to obtain. Look at the fact he was able to get in the theater, get out of the theater, and then get back in the theater. Courts will decide all of this, but one thing we can't forget is the victims. The victims are the important ones here. This guy will not see the light of day for a long, long time, and hopefully if there's a death penalty case in Colorado filed against him, that will happen too. I'm Dana Pretzer. And that's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.